This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Wednesday, February 8th, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Today, Donald Trump, he did a lot of things. Sometimes he does that. He ripped into a company that was losing money on the Ivanka Trump brand, said they were a terrible company. Here's what he wrote. Someday I hope to meet you. When that happens, you'll need a new nose, a lot of beefsteak for black eyes, and perhaps a supporter below. Actually, that wasn't Trump. Different president. That was Harry Truman lashing out at a critic of his daughter, Margaret, after a recital that was subpar. Some say it was subpar. I'm just going by the reporting at the time. What Trump did was a little different. Made a business decision. He's the president. He called him out on Twitter. But then Trump paused from putting Nordstrom on the rack with his speech to the major city's Chiefs Police Association. There he expressed disdain that anyone, including a judge, would find fault with his really simple-to-understand executive order barring immigration from seven countries.
If you were a good student in high school or a bad student in high school, you can understand this. Again, a bad high school student would understand this. Anybody would understand it.
Wait, perhaps that bad student he was talking about was Tim Scott, Republican of South Carolina. Yesterday, we found out that he admitted on the Senate floor that he was a bad student.
I failed world geography. I may be the first senator to fail civics. I even failed Spanish and English. When you fail Spanish and English, no one, Mr. President, considers you bilingual. No one. They did call me, by the way, bi-ignorant, because I cannot speak in any language. And that's where I found my unhappy self.
But actually, it wasn't Tim Scott, because Tim Scott issued a statement saying that even he had problems with the order. Quote, it is clear that the manner in which these measures were crafted and implemented have greatly contributed to the confusion, anxiety, and uncertainty of the past few days. But what I really want you to listen to are some other things Trump said and how he said them. Get to know his technique. This might be hard to parse, but give this a try.
I listened to a panel of judges, and I'll comment on that. I will not comment on the statements made by certainly one judge. But I have to be honest that if these judges wanted to, in my opinion, help the court in terms of respect for the court, they do what they should be doing. I mean, it's so sad.
Okay, you might not have gotten within that somewhat Byzantine context, but what he was doing there is saying, I will not comment on the judge, thereby commenting on the judge. I'm not going to criticize, but therefore wading into criticism. He does it again here.
I don't ever want to call a court biased, so I won't call it biased. And we haven't had a decision yet, but courts seem to be so political.
So this is what's called paralipsis. On our show, we had a scholar of American political rhetoric, Jennifer Murcia, and she talked about paralipsis, which is from the Greek that translates leave to the side. It is an ironic way for a speaker to say two things at once. And I'm not going to say Trump leans on this technique like Tiny Tim leaned on his tiny little crutch. That's what he does. Though I won't say that's what he does. On the show today, I spiel about the time Elizabeth Warren offended 106 years in the Senate. Before that, a conversation with the Sporkful's Dan Pashman about coffee. But first, I taught you about paralipsis, that Greek term. Now I shall lay a French term on you, le fake news. Can you guess the translation? Mm-hmm. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. After an election in the United States, which was decided by, well, a number of things, but the allegation of fake news was among them, it came down to Facebook and other big social media platforms to self-police. There was some acquiescence, but also some pushback within Facebook and like organizations about how much they could really do to control fake news. Now, since that time, the term fake news has pretty much exploded and been co-opted, and so now it means nothing. But what we're talking about is articles that are pretty much written just for the clicks and with a profit motive, though seemingly favoring candidates who are on the right. Maybe those people click those articles more. So we're talking about trying to flag for Facebook users when those articles are works of fiction or at least works of fact. Now, if we go to Europe, we find that Facebook in France seems to be doing more than Facebook in the United States is doing to police fake news. And since there's a big election in France, that could be relevant. Same is true in Germany. Joining me now is Will Arimus, who is the senior technology writer for Slate. Hello, Will.
Hi, Mike.
So let's stick to America before we go abroad. So Facebook knew that it was getting a lot of criticism, and they announced some initiatives. Did these go far enough? How much can Facebook do, and what were the initiatives?
So after the election, after it was sort of too late to make a difference, Facebook yes. jumped in and said, oh, we are going to take fake news seriously after all. We do have a role here. You know, it had really resisted that because Facebook has always been, it's always wanted to see itself as a sort of neutral platform where the value of any given piece of content is defined by its own users. Facebook doesn't want to be censoring that stuff or in the business of making those calls on users' behalf. But after the election said, all right, you know what? We're getting so much backlash here. And maybe we did just help a monster get elected to the highest office in the world. So maybe we should do something. And what they did is they partnered with some nonpartisan fact-checking organizations like FactCheck.org and Snopes. And Facebook built an algorithm that will surface stories that look like they might be fake news. So based on how people are clicking them, how people are sharing them, patterns that Facebook has identified in the data, they'll build this dashboard that then these fact-checking organizations can look at and go in and then sort of manually either verify or debunk some of these likely fake news stories. And then those will appear in your news feed. If they appear at all, they will appear with a little sort of a warning next to them saying this has been flagged as potentially a false story. Facebook also now lets users flag stories as potentially fake news.
That's a nightmare waiting to happen. Well, a food fight.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, Facebook's whole business is this food fight. This is what they do for a living. They fight against people who are trying to game their algorithm right. for profit. And so they're pretty good at it. And they make mistakes all the time, but they, you know, they sort of constantly learn and adjust. So I think Facebook, you know, I think the efforts are in the right direction in the United States. Whether they go far enough, it's really too soon to see. I mean, Facebook thought it had done stuff to curb hoaxes 2 or 3 years ago when the big concern was about about science hoaxes and nutrition, and if you eat 8 bananas a day, it'll cure your cancer.
Yes.
And those types
of clickbait articles were suppressed in the algorithm.
Yeah, it actually did help with that kind of stuff, and they sort of thought they had it under control, to be honest. And then this new political form emerged and just took them by surprise. Their algorithms weren't geared toward it, and it really proved far more virulent and also, you know, potentially sort of more impactful.
So I guess, and here we are still sticking in America, but I guess a criticism would be, well, the sites you factcheck.org and Snopes, I mean, these are already derided by people who don't want to believe they're fact-checking. And we saw how much good the fact that Donald Trump was the most fact-checked and adjudicated to be incorrect candidate in history. We saw how much good that did. But I guess you could say that it is the case that the Facebook articles that were being shared during the election, there was just no mechanism to really even know they existed. Maybe it'll be an innovation to some people to say, by the way, factcheck.org, which you might hate, says this is fake.
I think there are obviously a lot of people who are going to believe what they want to believe. And there is some academic research. It's early, so we can't take too much from it. But some early academic research suggests that fake news on Facebook is unlikely to have had much of an impact on the election's outcome. Simply for that reason. I mean, anybody who believed that the Pope endorsed Donald Trump was probably going to be a Trump voter, whether the Pope did or didn't endorse him, you know. But, you know, of course, there are people who are seeing these stories and maybe being fooled or maybe just being confused. But the real issue with Facebook to me is not the stuff that's outright fake news. It's not the easily debunked stuff. It's the way Facebook's algorithm incentivizes sensationalist headlines. And if users like being pandered to, if users enjoy, you know, getting political commentary that confirms their biases rather than challenging them, then it's really a tough pull, even if it wanted to, for Facebook to, you know, build software that gives them stuff they don't want to see.
Okay, let's go to Europe now. So in France, which has elections in April, Facebook has 24 million users in France. They're not just working with the referees. They're working with Le Monde. They're working with Agence France-Presse. They're working with the news organization to flag disputed articles.
I'm glad you said Agence France-Presse.
I don't know if I said it correctly. Yeah.
I was just going to go with AFP. Yeah, so Facebook is partnering with major European media organizations. And, you know, they're really, it's not a substantially different approach. I've seen some headlines claim that they're taking a different tack in Europe. It's not actually a substantially different approach from what they're now doing in the United States. It's a little different in that, you know, Le Monde and AFP are different from factcheck.org and Snopes. But basically, it's the same thing. The difference is that they're doing it before the big election instead of afterwards, right?
Yes.
They're doing it while there is still time to stop Marine Le Pen, if that is your goal. We'll see now what it might have looked like in the United States had Facebook put in place some of these measures before the election. I suspect it won't make a tremendous difference, but it seems worth doing regardless.
Okay, there's a big issue here, I think. But what do you think of this? Facebook has always argued that they're more like the phone company than the New York Times. They're just there to pass along information. You can't sue AT&T if someone says something libelous over the phone. I think that they're a little bit of some feet in each camp, but what we're talking about here is more like a news organization. But there is a law on the books that lets them off the hook as an intermediary. And this is why they always argue and always say, well, Facebook isn't in this business. And I wonder if in France and Germany, since it's a U.S. law I'm talking about, since that law isn't on the books, does this allow them to be, you know, more aggressive in terms of policing and perhaps acknowledging that they have many things in common with a news organization more so than the telephone company?
With the caveat that I'm not an expert on EU law, I will say that there are two major factors that are different in Europe from the United States, speaking very broadly. One is that there's less absolutism about free speech, about freedom of speech. There's
there's
a little less compunction about the government playing a more active role.
Right. In France, if you're a Holocaust denier, that's a criminal charge, right?
Exactly.
We have the First Amendment, so we would never have that.
Exactly. And so that opens the door, I think, for a company like Facebook or Google. We haven't really mentioned Google, but Google is doing much the same in response to fake news appearing in its search results and misinformation in its search results. That opens the door for those companies to be more proactive in Europe. The second issue is that Europe has taken a far more skeptical and cynical attitude toward the big U.S. tech companies, you know, maybe partly because they are American. You know, they're not European. And Germany in particular has the big German media conglomerate Axel Springer has sued Google again and again over stuff like putting media organizations' headlines in its search results or aggregating too much of a summary of their articles in its search results and on Google News. There's also a big EU antitrust push against Google. And so that skepticism toward the role of Google and Facebook in Europe, it could cut either way. You know, it could make people not trust Google and Facebook to check facts and to intervene in that way. It could, on the other hand, take an active role in policing content, even if it's not what they would prefer to do from a pure business standpoint.
Right, because they perceive that the climate in Europe is they don't think of Facebook and Google as good corporate citizens as much as maybe the United States do. Or they have a different standard on that.
Yeah, they don't think that, yes, that Silicon Valley is saving the world.
Right. And they don't don't make fun of Don't Be Evil for being naive. They make fun of it for being a lie.
Right. So there's a much bigger downside risk for Facebook and Google in being perceived as the bad guy in, yes, Europe than there is in the United States.
But if the fake news is allowed to slip through the cracks, and if, you know, Merkel's party loses and Le Pen's party wins, maybe this will change the regulatory environment of Europe.
There's always that risk, isn't there?
Well, yes. Will Aramis is the senior technology writer for Slate. Thank you so much, Will.
Thanks, Mike.
Dan Pashman is the host of the Sporkful podcast, and as such, he's a busy guy. He's crushing it on so many social media and media platform that he is what I would call a coffee achiever. And that is the discussion that we are to have today. Coffee, specifically office coffee. Hello, Dan.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
So office coffee, really kind of a weird subgenre of coffee. It's still coffee, and it's not just coffee in the office. It's coffee that the office has blessed and said this is our official coffee.
That's right, and it's the coffee that the office, that your employer is paying for.
Yes,
and so there's a very different dynamic with office coffee, because on one hand you don't have the choice. It's not like you're choosing which cafe to go to. Mm-hmm. That's the only coffee there is. On the other hand, you're not paying for it, and so it sort of feels like a nice perk that your employer is providing. So I thought this was really worth additional study.
Yes. So there is a continuum. Like if you could either go as cheap as possible and say, hey, I tick the box of just supplying any coffee, or you could go really high end, either because you think it's a nice thing to do, or maybe you think it's worth it. Like you think that the work that you inspire will more than pay for itself. And I know you looked into that.
Yeah, we talked to a behavioral economist in this episode of The Sporkful, and one of the things he said was that office coffee, these kinds of relatively small perks like office coffee, are not typically going to make people work harder. Typically, hard workers just work hard, regardless of the incentives. However, where it can come in is in attracting and retaining top workers. So it might not make people work harder, but it will make the hard workers like being there and stay longer. And so this is why you see in Silicon Valley, you know, Facebook and Google, Facebook has 11 restaurants. So they go way beyond office coffee in the perks that they provide. And so, you know, if you're deciding between a couple different companies and one of them has no coffee and the other one has a super fancy coffee, espresso, cappuccino, hot chocolate tea set up with honey and lemon and all different kinds of sweeteners at your disposal, then you may decide that that second employer is liable to treat you better overall and go with them.
Yeah. Although 10 of Facebook's restaurants are totally bona fide restaurant, and the 11th just serves like toy rubber food, and that's the fake food.
Right.
It's a big problem with Facebook. So that's true with all food perks. Like they're probably, you're not going to say, all right, I'll put in another hour because I really like the candy jar out front. But coffee stimulates you. It's a stimulative. So it might actually be scientifically wise to give better or higher caffeinated coffee, which I know you also looked into.
That's right. This was also part of the podcast because I had this idea, if I was ever like a boss and I had this office and this staff working, you know, when Sporkful Omnimedia really, really gets to the next level and I have to pick an office coffee for my office, I said to this caffeine researcher, wouldn't it make more sense for me to get a very highly caffeinated coffee, because she says, when I talk to her, you know, coffee is, or caffeine in general, caffeine is a performance enhancing drug.
Right. I know she said, well, it's not actually a stimulant, but it does suppress your tiredness. I'm like, that's kind of a stimulant.
Right. Well, it is a psychostimulant.
Yeah.
But yet, right, it does not actually give you energy. It suppresses the part of your brain that makes you feel tired, but it makes you
but
feel more alert.
But that's energy. Right. We take away.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally. You know, and so it makes you feel more alert, and it also puts you in a better mood. And so I said to her, wouldn't it make more sense for me to try to somehow sneak more caffeine into my office's supply so that all the workers start consuming, you know, may brew the coffee stronger or whatever, so that everyone who works there is more caffeinated and thus more productive.
Yeah.
And she said, actually, with caffeine as a drug, people tend to titrate their use, and they will, you know, they basically will stop drinking when they hit the buzz they want to hit.
Huh.
And so if you increase the caffeine in the office coffee, people will naturally, and perhaps even without realizing it, drink less.
And I know these caffeine researchers also told you that maybe the people who are making their choices about coffee aren't necessarily in the greatest frame of mind.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of research that shows that if you are feeling tired and or hungry at work, you are prone to decision-making biases in favor of, first of all, you will think more about the short term than the long term,
yeah,
and you'll be more prone to risk. If you are satisfied, you're not hungry, if you're alert and feeling good, you're more likely to look at the long term and be more risk averse.
Yeah, this is my theory with Bernie Madoff and the Ponzi scheme. It kept him up at night. Because he was up at night, he wasn't getting enough sleep. Because he was not getting enough sleep, he took more risks. It was just a never-ending cycle, and there we are today.
So you're blaming his crimes on sleep deprivation?
And lack of good coffee. So how did this all play out in your workplace where they had a vote on a new kind of coffee?
Yeah, so everyone, you know, at WNYC where I work, a lot of people were complaining for a long, long time about the office coffee. It didn't taste good. It was embarrassing to offer it to guests. And so they said, all right, we're going to pick a new office coffee. And so we follow this election process where at first they took nominations. People submitted like 100 different suggestions. It was whittled down to a list of 8. And then with the finalists, there was a company-wide taste test. And I thought it was very interesting just to see the way that people's expectations form around a perk, and the way that something that starts off being perceived as a perk,
yeah,
can so quickly become something that you expect,
yeah,
and then eventually resent.
Yeah, and then
it's
a matter
as good
of
as
life
you
and death. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right, right.
This is, by the way, how Obamacare and Social Security played out to the Republicans' mindset. They're going to want it, we're going to get them hooked, and then they're going to not let them go.
Right, right. You can't please all the people all the time.
Well, I'm more interested from a political science perspective. You had 8 brands. So did you do rank preference? Did you do instant runoff? How was the election held?
It was just whichever one got the most votes. And actually—
So there was no majority winner, just a plurality.
That's right. It was a plurality. The other issue with the election process that had me a little concerned was that next to each carafe, even though you didn't see the brand or anything, they were just numbered, there was a description. So it would, yeah, say, you know, medium bodied, you know, whatever, a hint of lavender. I don't remember what it said. There would be a description. And, you know, we have a lot of research which shows that when you tell someone in advance that something's going to taste a certain way or have certain tasting notes, then they're more likely to perceive those flavors.
Yeah. And
so that may have thrown off the results. You know, I was worried about that.
Right. Well, that gives me the idea of what I would do if I was the parsimonious boss. I would just have a really good description of the same old crappy coffee. It'll help things a little. Do you think that this will be the kind of coffee that years from now people say, remember we used to have bad coffee, now we can all agree it's good? Or there's just going to be another wave of discontent and they're going to want to recast the coffee eventually?
You know, times change. Tastes change. Nothing is forever, Mike.
Yeah.
Even great empires must crumble.
Wow.
I thought I'd leave you on a hopeful note.
Wow. and then, like Alexander the Great, Dan Pashman cried, for there were no more worlds or cups of coffee to conquer. Dan Pashman is the host of the Sporkful podcast. It's produced in partnership with WNYC, where they apparently have some better coffee these days. Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah. And now the spiel. The spiel is sometimes a ramble, sometimes a rhapsody, but it's rarely a rant. It's referred to as a rant. But spiel is to rant what a Riesling is to Four Loko. And yet today, though I rarely do it, today I must rant. Still, she persists. Elizabeth Warren was shushed, shut up, and sat down after Mitch McConnell invoked Rule 19 in the Senate.
Mr. President.
The Majority Leader.
The senators impugn the motives and conduct of our colleague from Alabama as warned by the chair.
No doubt you heard about this. She violated the sanctity and comedy of the cooling saucer that is the Senate. The Senate did not allow her to persist in her incorrigible calumny. That the offensive language that she was reading into the Senate record was a text already in the Senate record has been noted. That the words she was reading were from Coretta Scott King, that's been bemoaned. That this could possibly be a fundraising-based, motivating, meme-creating, unforced error by Senate Republicans, that has been speculated about. But what really bothers me is not the silencing of a woman, she is a senator, or the injury to the memory of Coretta Scott King during Black History Month, that's been pointed out. It is what the business of the Senate is, what occasioned Senator Warren reading this letter. The Senate was considering the nomination of Jeff Sessions to be Attorney General. Their job is to vet and probe the wisdom, the value, and the worth of Jeff Sessions as a nominee. It is the job of the Senate to give advice and consent to the president regarding his picks for cabinet. It is a constitutional requirement that they vote on the nomination, that they consider it fully, and that when they vote on it, they can say to the American people, we've done our constitutionally required duty. We've offered our approval. But what this rule, Rule 19, says is, there's an exception to that. Walk away the pros and cons of a nominee so far as the nominee is not a member of this august body. And if the nominee is a member, then the pros are fine, but the cons must be elided, must be glossed over, must be actually, in this case, if not expunged from history, at the very least, we have to be made not to remember what the cons of this nominee are. Putting aside the fact that this nomination is not in question. Of course, Jeff Sessions will get the vote, partly because he's a member in good standing of that body, and the chumminess or deference to fellow members is a key characteristic of that body, a characteristic that its members hold in high regard. But why is the Senate so highly regarded? Republicans say it's because we don't insult each other.
It went on and on and on, and much of her remarks were criticizing a fellow colleague in the Senate. I listened to her for quite a while, and she didn't have a good thing to say about a fellow senator here.
That is Orrin Hatch, Republican senator, Utah, and an adult in his 80s, making the point that in weighing the position of attorney general, Elizabeth Warren did not have anything nice to say about Jeff Sessions. In other words, he is saying the Senate is grand because we have a rule against speaking ill of each other. No. The Senate is a grand institution because the Constitution confers upon it that status. And among the tasks the Constitution spells out, which gives the senators their grandness, is the job, their job of offering real advice and bona fide consent. It's not a rule that says they should do this. It's not a resolution, not merely a law. It's the Constitution. And Elizabeth Warren, in her oh-so-terrible recitation of relevant facts already in the Senate record, was the one who was living up to the duties spelled out in the Constitution. And you, the senators who rebuked her in the name of Senate decorum, acted undecorously, uncivilly, and against the spirit of the document which gives you your power. And as a last thought, let's remember this, which has been said countless times in the last few months. It could be that the one hope we have for preserving our entire republic is the Senate, specifically Senate Republicans. Your Jeff Flakes, Susan Collins, Lindsey Graham's, John McCain's, who are said to understand and value the Constitution more than our president does. Only yesterday they didn't. That's it for today's show. Mary Wilson produces The Gist. We asked her to stop, but still, she persists. Chris Berube is the other Gist producer. He was censured for reading aloud a letter from Larry King. Steve Lickteig, executive producer of Slate Podcast, would like to hear what that Larry King letter had to say and calls upon Chris to introduce it into the record by saying these words, "Chris from Canada, you're on the air with William Shatner." Andy Bowers, chief executive officer of the Panoply Network, has been phoning it in for quite a while, but apparently that's enough to overturn an executive order. The gist. I don't want to say anything bad about Meet the Press, but it's very political. Very political. Oopru de pru du pru, and thanks for listening.